They seem on the surface to be the model couple. But sitting on my couch, opening up and talking to me, Leia, it talks about Shimon's drinking problem. Shimon's side of the story is that he feels he can never be enough for Leia. She believes he's an alcoholic, and she has a number of other things to say, but everything else pales in comparison with her experience of how much he drinks. Whatever he does, he is going to be nagged, he is going to be criticized, he is going to be put down, and it doesn't make a difference. Welcome to the Attached Life Podcast. You're listening to the Stories of Healing series. Each episode will give you a view into what inner healing looks like. Instead of just talking about therapeutic concepts, this series takes you inside the experience. Thank you for listening, and I hope you... This episode of the Stories of Healing series in the Attached Life Podcast is sponsored by my good friend who chooses to remain anonymous, but you know who you are. And thank you for supporting what we're trying to do here. So this episode is about a couple that I work with. And as always, this is really a conglomerate of couples that I've worked with and certain trends that I've seen over time. And I'm mixing and matching details of different people's stories to create a fictional story that serves as a template of a very real story that so many people live through and can hopefully bring some insight into dynamics that you or other people you know might be experiencing in your own unique way. So this couple, we'll call them Shimon and Leia. Shimon and Leia are in their late 30s. They are a couple that in the community holds very high regard. They present very well. They look very put together. They have a few children who are, thank God, healthy and doing well in school and doing well in the community. And Shimon's business is very financially successful. Leia is a happy stay-at-home mom, running the household, doing a lot, working out, socializing, involved in community initiatives and different things, and they seem in many ways on the surface to be the model couple, the model family. But sitting on my couch and opening up and talking to me, they acknowledge so much of that and so many of the good things that their life on a material level and on a communal level that their life seems to have in place and how far they've come in those regards. But yet they describe that since the very beginning of their relationship, things have been quite tumultuous with a lot of ups and downs. They do have times that are very good and they can connect in very meaningful and positive ways that they can both really enjoy. But there's a lot in between those moments. And the core complaints or narratives that they present me with are that Leia, it talks about Shimon's drinking problem, that she believes he's an alcoholic. She believes that he drinks too much and that he's drinking all the time. And she has a number of other things to say, but everything else pales in comparison with her experience of how much he drinks and how much that gets in the way of their lives and how uncomfortable it makes her and how she feels that it affects their home and their children and their marriage and Shimon's consistency and Shimon's presence and Shimon's being home and versus being out and involved in other things. And when he is home, is he there? Is he really home? Is there someone really home inside him? How much he's drinking? Now, it's tricky because with all his drinking, he's never hit a quote-unquote rock bottom in the classic way, meaning to say that on the surface, he seems to be doing well, as I said before. He has been very successful financially in business. He has made a very significant place for himself in the community. He is held in high regard. He has many, many very connected and meaningful relationships with a lot of people. He's very well liked. And his drinking has never, again, on a surface level, in the more typical way, his drinking has never led him to hit a rock bottom of a life failure, let's say, if we call it. But for Leia, Shimon's drinking really gets in the way of any semblance of a stable life that she is so desperately seeking and craving and wanting for herself together. That's Leia's side of the story. Shimon's side of the story is that he feels he can never be enough for Leia. He feels that whatever he does, he is going to be nagged, he is going to be criticized, he is going to be put down, and it doesn't make a difference. And in his mind, it could be that I am drinking too much, but if I wasn't drinking, it would be the exact same thing, it would just be about something else. The easy go-to for Leia is to bother me and criticize me for the drinking, but there have been many, many times where I have made much better choices about drinking much less, drinking in a moderate amount, or not even drinking at all, taking a chunk of time away from having any alcohol, and it doesn't matter because no matter what I do, I'll be put down, orders will be barked at me, I will be spoken down to, I will be treated disrespectfully, no matter how much I provide, no matter what kind of lifestyle and comforts I'm able to offer and able to bring to her and to our family, no matter what I do, something is going to be picked at and I'm going to be treated harshly. And that's what Shimon describes as his experience in the marriage. So that's how they come in, that's the presentation. And I've seen so many variations of this exact type of dynamic in different couples. So whether what I just described is exactly how you, in your experience, have that experience or some other variation of that, it's a very common phenomenon in one way or another. So I ask them a bit more about the dynamic that they have and to tell me a little bit more about the ins and outs of it. Like what is a regular week look like? What does a Shabbos look like? What do vacations they go on together look like? What kind of time do they spend together? All these kinds of questions just to get a bit more of the landscape and the details of what's going on here. They explain to me that during the week that there's somewhat of a typical cycle for them in a sense. During the week, they're both very busy, as most of us are. And so for the most part during the week, it's relatively non-eventful. They don't have much quality connection. They're not really feeling a whole lot of togetherness, and they're not necessarily investing their time into creating that with each other. So it's not that during the week it's great, but during the week it's fine. And there can even be moments that can be good. And then Shabbos comes, and Shabbos starts sometimes if they've had a decent or maybe even somewhat better week. At the beginning of Shabbos, things can actually be nice. But then as Shabbos goes, very often Leia can be extremely tired. A difficult day on Friday with the kids preparing Shabbos, all those kinds of things, and the meal can come, and Leia is kind of checked out and feels very tired and kind of either passes out on the couch or kind of slips away into just falling asleep or whatever it is. And then that's kind of where things then begin to unravel, because at that point, Shimon feels, I've tried to be more present in the ways that Leia wants me to. I'm trying to do different things. I'm trying to engage the kids. I'm trying to be an active, proactive, hands-on father. I'm here. I'm not out. I may have even left shul early and not hung around hocking with all the guys because I was trying to prioritize being home the way that I'm being asked to be. And here I am, and I'm showing up, and I'm doing the best I can, and I'm not having the extra l'chaim or anything like that. And she's just kind of passed on the couch and expects me to do everything with the kids now and put the kids to sleep. And I really wanted to say a Dvar Torah at the meal. I wanted to sing something. I wanted to have a family moment and experience. And she's not even, she doesn't put any effort into it. And she's tired, but I'm also tired. And so at that point, Shimon does what he has to do in terms of the meal and the kids and all that. But then, as so often is the case, there are opportunities. There's a Shalom Zachar, there's a Tish, there's an Oneg, there's something going on, there's a friend's house to go to. And so feeling kind of defeated, feeling kind of alone, feeling that it's kind of pointless for me to be putting in this effort, Shimon then might leave the house, might go to somewhere else, go to a Shalom Zachar, something, one way or the other. and then goes back to drinking because in Shimon's mind, well, what was the point of not drinking? And so it's not any better if I don't. And so he begins drinking and then comes home, in his words, not completely blacked out or gone or hammered or whatever you want to call it, but just, you know, a bit tipsy or a bit intoxicated, and comes home pretty late, and Leah can tell, and that bothers her. And then the next morning, he's sleeping in a bit, he's tired, he's a bit weighed down by the alcohol, etc. And that leads Leah to now kind of be relating to him in a very cold way. And she's distanced now. She is turned off by him. She is unattracted to him. She is not interested in this relationship in that moment. That is something that really pushes her away. And so then they kind of go into this cold war. Sometimes it leads to actual argument. Sometimes it leads to fighting. But most often it will start as a bit of a cold war. And so then that whole day will just be a cold war with kind of going through the motions of, you know, what Shabbos is like as a family with their kids and with friends and guests and going out for a meal, having company, whatever it is, but they're not really talking. Shabbos ends, and now it's Motzei Shabbos, and the kids are asleep, and the house is finally quiet. And after a day of a cold war, now one of them is going to initiate something, but they don't necessarily do it very skillfully. And so the initiation of that conversation about what happened and why are we upset and who's upset and who did something wrong leads into a spiraling of escalated fighting, blaming each other. You were so disinterested last night. You just checked out. You left me with the kids. I've been trying to do this for you all week. I've been trying to show up in a better way. And Leah's response, you know, you just got home drunk again and I was exhausted. And all the second that you're upset about something, you just turn to alcohol again. And okay, so you were trying, but you know, one thing goes not exactly the way you wanted. And then you come home drunk a few hours later. And so then it just kind of, it kind of boils over. And a lot of hurtful things are said, a lot of anger comes out at each other, and they kind of go back into a cold war, and that will then oftentimes last through Sunday until just the fact that maybe one of them will fall on their sword, or the busyness of life and the routine of life as the week begins again and they get distracted into their own worlds, that actually kind of stabilizes things in a kind of interesting way, because it stabilizes things by actually distancing a bit more, but at the same time allows for some semblance or some level of restarting connection as the week begins. And that process of the week into Shabbos and then Shabbos and into Motzei Shabbos and into Sunday and back into the week, that process essentially repeats itself week in and week out in a variety of different ways. So the way that I think about these things and try to understand what's going on in a couple's dynamic is not limited to, but often involves understanding the individual's background and where these kinds of patterns or dynamics are coming from, because I don't think that anything is born today or yesterday, but things emerge or come from a certain process, and no one is trying to do anything bad or hurtful. But there's a way that we develop and we kind of form different challenging or even problematic or bad habits that are not really rooted in badness or evil, but are rooted in different challenges or struggles or pain that we may have experienced. And so I try to understand a little bit more about Shimon and Leah's background and ask them some questions about their upbringing and their family of origin and life experience prior to marriage, before anything to do with each other at all. And I'll show you why that can be a very helpful piece of this process. So I asked them about themselves, and I'll tell you just in brief kind of what I got from Shimon and what I got from Leah. And so Shimon described to me that he grew up and nothing particularly noteworthy at home that he had to say. He had a lot of kind of interesting, somewhat regular experiences at home. Nothing outstandingly amazing for him in terms of relationship support and emotional nurturance, but very there and fine and present, kind of in a sense, maybe even pariv, we can call it. And there's more to talk about in what that means, and you know, is that possible, right? In some sense, is pariv pariv. But the more important part for our for our purposes is that he described as a teenager, as a young teen, and then into teenage years, socially at school and in the community, feeling that he was kind of perpetually or chronically at the edge of a social group. So he felt, in a sense, that he was, let's call it, to use very kind of adolescent terminology, because this is about adolescent years, he felt that he was cooler than the non-cool group, but he wasn't cool enough to be in the cool group. So he was in the cool group, but he wasn't really in. He was kind of at the very edge of it, the very entrance to it, and he never really made it. So he was able to kind of participate. He was able to be there, but he didn't feel that he was really one of them. And that was a very difficult experience. And I kind of just want to mention connecting that back to the family piece being very parve. I think that's also important. It was good at home, but there was still something kind of parve about it, which I think then feeds into the feeling of loneliness if socially also there's a sense of not really fully being on the inside. And one of the things that then developed was that socially, in the culture he was in and the social groups he was trying to be a part of, drinking and alcohol became kind of a currency of coolness and machoism and being on the in-group. And so he actually then eventually did get to the inside of the group and did feel very part of it, because he developed drinking as a way to be cool. And he became, quote unquote, one of the best drinkers. So he could drink the most and he can, et cetera. And drinking really became a part of how he made it eventually. And so there's more to say, but that's kind of the background for Shimon. Leah grew up in a bit of a different background. Unfortunately, it's very sad. She grew up with a father who was very ill for most of her life. His health had its ups and downs, but generally speaking, he was struggling with his health. And because of it, he was very limited. And so despite being a caring and kind person who wanted to do good for her and for his family, he was extremely limited as he was battling with health issues most of the time. And as a result of that, Leah's mother was really a caretaker to her father and was really tending to his medical issues a lot, as well as juggling a myriad of responsibilities that were falling on her to be the breadwinner, to be the homemaker, to be virtually everything. And because of that, Leah grew up with a sense of not having that connection and that stability of a home that was solid and had its grounding and a sense of real presence and of the parents to be there for her, and having an experience of a Shabbos meal or a Yontif meal or a family experience in the way that is so often what we look at as being normal or being what we want or naturally what a child would want. Holomoi trip as a family, a Sunday experience as a family, these types of things were very limited, very scarce for her. And so hearing these two backgrounds of Shimon and Leah, I start to sense what to me became a bit more clear as to what the dynamic here was and why it was so profoundly triggering and difficult for each other. And so I turned to Shimon and I said, I want you to try and imagine. I actually said this to both of them, not only to Shimon. I said, can you each imagine a situation where you have a couple, and let's say the husband gives his wife everything he could possibly think of giving her. He provides her with everything, materially, emotionally, physically, in all ways. He gives her everything. And he is the most incredible and present and generous person. But he does all that except for one thing. He doesn't give her any food. No food. And she's not allowed it. She doesn't have access to food. And so he's giving her everything. Everything a person could dream of and more. But she doesn't have food. And someone would look at that situation, and could you imagine, would this lady, would this wife be appreciative of her husband, or be deeply upset and angry and scared and struggling? Obviously, in the example, I mean, struggling literally to be alive, but that's not the point. I mean, figuratively speaking, it doesn't matter that she's getting every single thing, because the most essential thing she needs isn't there. So he could be giving her an endless line of credit to go to every store for all the clothing she wants, or to go on this vacation, or to go, or to enjoy even his company, but she doesn't have the strength to do it, because the basic nurturing that she needs, the basic thing she needs, isn't there. So she can't even access or receive all the other things. And that's an important point. It's not just that she has all the things he's giving her, but there's something important missing. It's that because the thing missing is so essential, she doesn't even get to experience or access all the things that he is giving her. Each person has different things that are their food. So for all of us, food is food, and would actually qualify for that basic need in this example, illustration. But it's not just food, because each of us has different things that, because of our nature, our predisposition, and our life experiences especially, different things that are the essential food that we need from our spouse in order for everything else to click. And for Leia, that food is a sense of stability. Because for her and her background and her life experience, what was missing most was a consistent sense of things are safe, things are okay, things are stable. Because in her life experience, to no one's fault necessarily, her father was dealing with health issues, but things were volatile, things were unpredictable, things were fragile. There was no sense of status quo stability. And all she deeply yearns for and longed for is a home in which there's a basic predictability, there's a basic stability. And so when Shimon drinks, even if it's a little bit, if it's a lot, if he stops, but I don't know when it's going to start again, if he goes off of it, but then is he really off of it? And if he's in that situation, what's he going to be doing? And when is he coming home? And what state will he be in? All of that is so deeply unsettling and unraveling for her, because it brings her back to this sense of instability, the sense that things are not predictable. And so for anyone to experience someone who has a compulsive relationship with a intoxicating or mind-altering substance would be very difficult. And the details of Shimon's level of possible alcoholism or addiction are very important, but in a certain sense, in this context, in terms of the couple dynamic, almost becomes actually a secondary conversation. Because what Shimon needs to understand is that for his wife, predictability and stability is the food. And so he's so frustrated that I do all these things for you. I'm so hands-on with the kids. I provide us with such a materially comfortable and enjoyable life. I am so involved in so many different initiatives, and I work so hard, and I do so much, and I prioritize so many different things for us, for you. I do so much for you, and yet it's never enough for you. You're always bickering and nagging and upset about something. And I turn to Shimon and ask him, can you imagine you do all those things, but she doesn't have food to eat? Would you expect her to be appreciative? So you do all those things, and I get it, and I respect that, and I get why it's frustrating. But if you can understand that there's something that she needs, that's her food, her basic sustenance, that a certain aspect of your lifestyle and your choices and your behaviors don't provide her, and actually provide her with the opposite of the food that she needs. So it makes it that she actually can't even access any of the things that you are giving her. They can't register as being meaningful to her. And as I'm saying all this, I actually see both of them really starting to well up with emotion. And he gets it. He can see that. And I turn to her and want to explain the exact same phenomenon. For Shimon, what's the food? For Shimon, the food is the experience of feeling respected, feeling accepted for who I am. Because in his social dynamic and experience, he felt that he was never enough, never good enough, never really on the inside. And so when his wife is nagging him and criticizing and nitpicking and not happy with what he does, despite all the good things that he does do and the level of success that he enjoys in the eyes of so many other people, but it's not enough for her. So that goes right to the core. It goes to the most raw spot for him. And it pulls all the food that he needs away. Because he feels so disrespected by the person that he most needs and wants that respect from. And so unappreciated by that person. And that then creates a dynamic. Because if you think about it, when those two phenomena come together, they feed off each other in a way that makes so much sense. So Shimon does all these things that he thinks should be appreciated, but he's a bit unpredictable because of his drinking, which means that now Leah feels that she can't even appreciate any of the things he is doing because she feels so unstable and so malnourished by him. Because it's so unpredictable and chaotic. And so now she's not appreciative of him at all. And now think about what happens next. So he feels disrespected, underappreciated, and that puts him exactly back where it all started. A relationship where he is not wanted. And how did he find himself socially when he felt not wanted? How did he gain the social success that he was longing for when he felt like an outsider? He started drinking. That was what happened back in high school. So now he feels disrespected. What's he going to do? He's going to go drink. And then what happens when he drinks? She feels even more unpredictability, more status quo instability. So what does she do now? She appreciates and respects the good things that he does even less. And now she's even more nagging and more difficult to him and more disrespecting of him. And what's he going to do when he feels even more disrespected and criticized? He's going to go to drink. And then what's going to happen to her? It's going to feel even more unpredictable. And so it feeds off each other in this very vicious cycle and exacerbates each person's problem even more. And as I'm describing this, it's clicking so much and they can both really see it. And the beginning of all healing and all change is understanding. And so even just understanding this dynamic and this process, this dance, this negative cycle, how it feeds off each other is so important. In some ways, I think it's important to also acknowledge that in many ways this is kind of classic. It's the classic male-female dynamic. And there are many ways that people talk about differences between men and women that I don't find to really be so consistently true. But there are a few that I actually really do think have a lot of truth to them. One is that it is one that's very relevant to this conversation, which is that women in general desire deeply a feeling loved. And men desire deeply a feeling of feeling respected. Now, both people need to feel respected and both people need to feel loved. But the stronger characteristic of it for women is that feeling of loved, and for men, the feeling of being respected. And so in this context, what's really happening is that Leia is not feeling loved by Shimon's choices and actions that create so much instability for her. And then she's not respecting Shimon. Shimon feels disrespected, which then allows him or leads him to engage in behaviors that make her feel more unloved, which then makes him feel more disrespected, and it goes around and around in that cycle. So after we have the sense of a bit more understanding and clarity of this dynamic, which, like I said, is a huge piece of the process, is just to really get understanding, the question then becomes, okay, so now what's next? And this brings me to a point that I think is so important. The way I think about it is that the American concept of marriage is that my spouse is the perfect person to make me happy. The way I like to think about it is that the spiritual concept of marriage is that my spouse is the perfect person for me to be on my journey, if you will. Oh, that's become quite a trite word, but is the perfect person for me to develop myself, which will then, when done right, make me deeply and profoundly happy. But they're not necessarily the perfect person for me to be happy. They're the perfect person for me to develop and heal and become who I need to be. And so if you think about Shimon and Leia, and this is how I experience so many couples, there's a certain conflict, or a certain, let me change that word, not conflict, there's a certain discrepancy, differentiation between each person's nature and makeup. And when that discrepancy meets, when the two different natures meet, there's a crossroads. There's an option in which the discrepancy creates the type of cycle I described before, where my nature triggers your nature, which then in turn triggers my nature. And so I started at X and you started at Y. And now I become X to the nth degree and you become Y to the nth degree, and we move farther and farther away. So just to give an example what I mean by that, take an anxious and an avoidant attachment style couple. So the anxious attachment style person is the person who needs a lot of reassurance, needs a lot of closeness, a lot of connection, a lot of togetherness. The avoidant attachment style person is the person who wants a lot of space, doesn't really know or want to engage in difficult conversations, wants to kind of shut down the conversation, wants to avoid, wants to pull away, doesn't want to engage in high-level emotion or activation. So what happens in that dynamic is that the person who's anxious is anxious, and the person who's avoidant now experiences the other person's desire for reassurance or closeness, and that makes them more avoidant because they feel suffocated by it. So they become more avoidant and they withdraw. And what happens to the anxious person when their spouse withdraws? They get more anxious. So now they become even more needy. And what happens to the avoidant when their spouse gets more needy? They get more avoidant. And then that makes the anxious person more anxious. And so now the two people have spiraled each other. And so the discrepancy in their nature feeds off each other in a way that builds the problem. But there's another version of how this can go, which is that discrepancy actually is the magic that helps each person develop further who they are, and that the discrepancy actually complements each other instead of conflicting with each other. And what I mean by that is the anxious person brings something very valuable into the relationship, which is that they pull the relationship closer. They bring issues that need to be talked about and dealt with into vision. They try to initiate closeness. They try to be proactive to build the relationship. But there is a downside to that anxious style, which is that things can escalate. The anxious person can have a very hard time pausing, zooming out, getting perspective, slowing down, allowing for there to be space and time. Now take the avoidant on the flip side. There is something very positive about the avoidant, which is that they know how to slow down and zoom out and take perspective and recalibrate and try to get to maybe a little bit more of an objective place. They know how to ground and avoid escalation of people getting so angry that they start saying hurtful things and getting mad and blowing things out of proportion. But there's a downside to the avoidant, which is, well, avoidance and suppressing things and skirting the issue and allowing a relationship to drift apart because we're not being proactive about connection, etc. And so what can happen when done right is that the avoidant person can actually help the anxious and the anxious can help the avoidant because they can complement each other well. And being married to an avoidant person will force the anxious person to learn how to slow down while still maintaining the gift of their proactivity towards the relationship. And the avoidant person will be forced by their anxious spouse to lean more into the difficulty of certain conversations, to lean more into proactive relationship building, while still maintaining the gift of their ability to slow down and reset. And so instead of spiraling each other out, we bring each other closer in. So the anxious moves a little more towards a balanced middle from their side of the spectrum, and the avoidant moves a little more towards a balanced center from their side of the spectrum. And they help each other. In our couple, Shimon and Leah, it's complicated. Because if there's really a strong addiction present, and the way that I painted the picture, it kind of sounds like there is. It depends on which client I'm thinking of as to how black and white that is, because, again, this is a conglomerate of so many different people. But if there's really an addiction present, then, and it's active and it's not being dealt with, then that kind of pulls the rug from underneath so much. And it's almost like we're kind of stuck until that's really able to be addressed. But if we put that aside for a moment, Leah's need for stability has led her to a bit of a perfectionism. Maybe even like a borderline OCD type nature. Things need to be very in a box, very perfect, very particular, very exact. And a very difficult time with just kind of being, going with the flow, experiencing, being able to enjoy things, and being able to relate to things positively. And her relationship with Shimon is calling her to have to figure out inside herself how to heal and how to move a little bit more towards, yes, it's okay to want stability. It's good to want that. But if I want stability to the point that it means I can never even be okay with anything, then it's actually overcompensating and it's getting in the way of the quality of my life, not enhancing it. And so in this marriage with Shimon, again, putting aside the complication of a full-fledged addiction, she needs to learn how to be a little bit more okay with when something's not perfect. And being married to someone who has that kind of flaw is actually exactly what she needs, not to be happy, but it's exactly what she needs to be developing herself towards a more wholesome, healed, fully embodied person. And so the problem is the perfect problem for her. And that's not coincidence. That's the spiritual perspective on marriage, that the problem of her spouse, which is so deeply triggering to her, is the perfect problem for her process of healing. And the same is true for Shimon. He so deeply needs and craves that feeling of respect. And when he doesn't feel the respect, he turns to the coping mechanism that once worked but is now such a problem. And he needs to develop that sense of, I can find other ways to feel respected and to find that inner sense of being respected. And I can find a place of okayness with when I'm not perfect and I'm not fully respected because I made a mistake. But I have enough self-worth with that I'm okay, that I'm not the high school kid who's on the outskirts of that anymore. There's an update to my system. And that's a healing process that he needs to find within himself. And his marriage to Leah is triggering exactly that problem, and it's the perfect problem for him to have triggered. So they're both triggering each other to surface what each of them needs to be looking at within themselves. And so there is a dynamic within the couple that needs healing and needs attention. But really the dynamic within the coupleship is bringing to light what each of them needs in their own inner healing and their own inner work. And I see that dynamic take place again and again and again within so many couples. And there is a way to do some of this in a couple's context, but really it also then shifts into a lot of deep individual work and reframing this struggle and this challenge into an opportunity for my own inner healing. And when I can do that, and especially when I can do that with regards to the triggers that come from my spouse, and I can understand their perspective, I can understand where they're coming from, going back to the analogy of the food, I can see where they're coming from. It's still difficult, but I can create the space for them to experience this the way they're experiencing it and understand that there's something deeply triggering about what I'm doing for them. And really holding in mind this vision of, instead of our discrepancy creating an explosion of us each becoming more firmly entrenched in our problematic response, the discrepancy can actually bring each of us closer towards that center. And it's the problem that we're facing from each other is the perfect problem for me to develop in exactly the way I need to be developing. This couple has a lot of work ahead of them, but the session started with a lot of eye rolling and a lot of passive aggressive body language towards each other when they're each saying their perspective and cutting each other off. And it ended with a lot more tears that were genuine and real, and a lot more understanding of each other, and a lot more compassion, a lot more spaciousness for this experience. And my hope is that it's not going to be perfect, and it's going to be messy because this is a challenging type of situation. But they are not alone in this. This is something that some version of this in different ways is common for so many people. And so I hope that hearing this story and seeing marriage through this lens can offer people who might feel a sense of just being lost in their relationship and feeling like everything's wrong and I've married the wrong person. Could be, but it could also be that everything that's wrong about it is actually exactly the problem that you need to be facing for your process and in building yourself as a person. And that when you do that, again, there's no beginning and end, so it's not when you do that and you're done, but when you do that, there is a very, very deep, meaningful experience of joy and connection and intimacy and fulfillment that a marriage that's looked at from this perspective can experience.